Okay, so in some way, what I was just exploring in the meditation was having kind of two purposes. One is just to kind of introduce that way of meditating with the breath that isn't so fixed in the anatomy of the breath, the biology of the breath. And also because I like doing it. And it feels very kind of helpful to me. And I think some of the topic of what I want to cover this evening is actually, how do we relate to our body? How do we relate to our breath? And how can we relate to it in ways which are really supportive? And actually have this flavor of metta to them. Should I speak louder?
Yes?
Okay.
Please.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. So there's a wonderful metaphor for the practice that we do, which is the clear forest pool. I don't know if many people have kind of come across this. It's quite commonly kind of thrown out by Dharma teachers who want to kind of give that feeling of something quite precious inside of us. But letting our mind be like a clear forest pool. It comes from A clear forest pool, like a collection of water, like a little lake that's very, very clear, like you can see the bottom, and it's in a forest. And it actually comes from the Thai forest tradition, from Ajahn Chah. And it kind of gives that sense of, when we think of that space, it actually has quite a magical kind of quality to it. And if we were nearby to it, we might see kind of very shy creatures come and just drink very gently from that pool. And it's kind of a way of generating in us an image, and these images can be very useful sometimes as kind of navigation signs of like what we want to support. It really has that kind of atmosphere of metta, if we kind of consider it, to actually make our minds like a clear forest pool. Actually sounds both perhaps really just wonderful. Well, I imagine having a mind like a clear forest pool when I compare it to the mind that I live with most of the time. But also just like how welcoming that is, what a resource that is for all other kinds of living beings. And that also really brings that kind of metta attitude. So what that means is the more we stir up the water, the more we don't allow the forest pool to become clear. That we can kind of imagine, the more we kind of dig in there, the more we resist, and we kind of like, I don't want that in there, and start throwing things out, we kind of churn up the water and don't get to that moments of clarity. But in a certain sense, if we can rest back, if we can allow for things to arise and pass, you know, things can move through the forest pool without churning up the bottom. They can move through, they can exist in our minds without disturbing the clarity, without disturbing the calm. That it calms, we calm. We can generate this quality of calm. And someone mentioned a really remarkable insight in one of the groups, you know, that, or in the hall, maybe it was. That if we resist doing anything in the stillness meditation, if we kind of just resist to do, you may have noticed one of the things our mind comes up with is great ideas of things to do. Oh, move your leg. Oh, think about this. Oh, go there. And we actually just kind of stay centered and we observe these things coming through. We observe the impulses coming through. That we actually rest into something calmer. So not following those urges actually is what supports that peace. And so part of what this meditation before was looking at is ways that we can move through the body in ways that don't disturb it, but actually calm it. We can actually use the breath in these ways that it doesn't agitate the body, but it actually calms the body to get that attention, to get that relief in the way that we look. And of course, that may work for some of us and not for others. And you know, it may have just been a very annoying meditation and now I feel so much less peace and I actually was a clear forest pool, but then this joker from overseas comes in and just stirred it all up with this stupid idea he has. But if we did get some peace, then we can see, you know, that's the fruit of good practice. And if we've had moments of peace through the day, you know, that's the fruit of metta practice. You know, that's the way that we can kind of see what's going on in our experience. It can be one of the ways we can lightly measure, in the sense of like tasting our experience. So all of these Dharma teachings are focused around dukkha, stress, distress, even to the degree of suffering, right? And they're all related to the easing of that. So the easing of this is the peacefulness. We could say, you know, when there's struggle and demand, and when that eases, yeah, so kind of, and then that kind of can ease, that can open palm attitude we can have to life, is the way of resolving dukkha. Right? They actually depend. Yeah, no problem. Thanks for mentioning that. Yeah. So the struggle and the demand actually is what creates the stress. And we have our habitual ways of going through life where we respond or even react to life in ways that we feel that our happiness and well-being comes from getting rid of things, or from getting what we want. But what the Dharma teachings are pointing towards is that feeling of relief when we get something, or when we finally get rid of something else. That feeling of relief is actually the absence of the craving, the absence of the demanding, of the struggle. Right? It's not actually the getting of the thing that brings that feeling of happiness. Right? Happiness isn't in the thing, it's in you. And we can actually get to that happiness, that well-being, by changing the relationship. Okay? So maybe this sounds like something very complicated, maybe this sounds like something we've heard many, many times before. But it's just a very typical misperception, a mistaking of the way, you know, our life unfolds. You know, we get something, and we feel, oh, that did it, that fixed it, that relieved it. But it didn't, actually. What relieved it was the absence of the struggle, the absence of the demand. Yeah? Does that make sense? Okay. So even if this is just a way of looking at the thing, it can be useful as a way of exploring our experience. And we can keep investigating. And in this way, if we are actually seeing it for how it is, we're learning how it works, then each time we do that, we can take the insight, we can learn from it, because that in there lies the key. The key is changing the relationship. So many times we look at experience as we need to change the thing. Either it has to come into my ownership, or I have to get rid of it out of my life, and then it will be resolved. And so what metta is a way of approaching life which isn't making this demand. It isn't making this struggle. And so when it's kind of flowing for us, we feel that sense of ease. Yeah. So metta is this kind of absence of the dukkha, absence of the stress and the distress. And so we've mentioned emptiness and fabrication before. And of course these sound like very advanced words and very kind of complex things. But this is just another example of it. We can change our relationship to something, right? If we can change our relationship to something, then the way that thing appears will change according to the relationship. The thing doesn't exist on its own, separate from the relationship that we've given to it, you know, or we're interacting with it. So if we change from having a struggle and a stressful and a dukkha relationship to something, and we change that to a metta, to an easeful, to a peaceful relationship to something, that object itself also changes how it appears to us, changes in what it means to us. And that's really what emptiness is pointing towards. And where emptiness becomes meaningful is in the easing of dukkha. Right? That's the only place where it can really be meaningful to us, where it transforms experience. So the sign of understanding emptiness, the sign of metta flowing well, is that sign that things become more easeful, right? When we come in, when we welcome, when we ease into the relationship. And one of the aspects where the dukkha experience feels very profound, feels very difficult for us, is that it also increases that sense of self, increases our sense of being in a problematic mode, being in a difficult situation, much stronger a sense of ourselves. And you may have noticed in moments where you're feeling quite easeful, where things are feeling that they're really kind of flowing along for us, that there isn't really a sense of self. There's no sense of even needing to own ease. Yeah? It's just ease. Things are just easeful. Things are just flowing along. And to maybe aid some kind of understanding of this, we'll actually go away from here, go away from ourselves, go away from this present moment even, and go off into the distant past. And hear a little story of the Buddha and what he was getting up to, and see how that kind of, we can just let go of this being about us. Yeah. This isn't about us getting better. This isn't about us being something special. We don't even need to be a meditator. We're just going to listen to a little story, and we're going to have a nice time, and we're just going to relax. So just to give you a sense of a time before you existed, there's a lovely Zen koan which says, "What was your face like before your parents were born?" What was your face like before your parents were born? So that's who you are as you listen along. And for those who are interested, this is from the middle length sayings, the minor discourse in the Gosinga forest. And the translation I'm using is from Bhikkhu Bodhi. So in the beginning of this story, the Buddha is wandering around, and it seems like he's going around and just meeting up with his students who've gone off to do long-term practice. And he comes to this forest, and there's a forest keeper, and he doesn't recognize that it's the Buddha. There's a little bit of kind of playful humor in this teaching, in this sutta. And so he says to him, "Recluse, You can't go in there. There are three monks, three practitioners who are doing their long-term practice for well-being, for welfare. Sounds like they're actually doing metta practice from the atmosphere of it." And so the Buddha is, not arguing, not demanding that he can come in. And there's something quite beautiful here, that sometimes you'll hear there's epithets, these little kind of phrases that are given towards the Buddha, that he was a kinsman of the sun, that he was from the same family as that big, bright, fiery ball in the sky. And there was kind of a radiance about him. He walked around and, flowers popped up behind his footsteps and things like this. But somehow, it seems in this story, he just looked like everybody else. So there's this kind of atmosphere we can imagine. He was just a kind and wise person. Yeah, that kind of same aspiration that we can have, to be a kind and wise person. But we can also attune to the fact that we often don't notice kind and wise people. Yeah? They don't draw our attention so much. And we can mistake them. Just mistake them for someone else. So anyway, while he's at the gate, luckily the people inside notice or somehow sense that he's come. And they say, "Forest keeper, thank you. This is our teacher. We'd like to let him come in." And so he comes in, they prepare some space for him, and he sits down. And after they've done all the kind of formalities, he turns to them and says, "I hope you are keeping well. I hope you are all comfortable. I hope you're not getting any trouble getting your food." And I just think that's just such a sweet way to begin a meeting, a conversation, a teaching with those he hasn't seen for a while. And there's something quite touching in that movement of kindness. But also, I think it also kind of touches us into, now we've traveled back in time to this time, of actually the real uncertainties in life and the uncertainty of the way that these people were practicing. And the dedication that it took to sit in a forest where there were many wild creatures, and also just to ask for your food. You know, in comparison, our retreat here really must seem sound like luxury. Like maybe they just couldn't believe, you know, what we have to go through to do a retreat these days, you know. And but it can still feel like work for us, you know. It can still feel like a struggle. You know, there's still a lot of things to fear. There's still a lot of process to go through. And in this way, you know, the teachings come around and they still resonate because of those broad, similar contexts that we can feel. Fear, not having enough, not being safe, not being respected, not being all of the things that we can get into. And so within that, really feeling welcome to make this retreat your retreat. Make this retreat what you need it to be. Make it nourish those aspects of your life that you wish to support. And so that we're offering out these teachings that they're actually, I sometimes think they're actually quite vague, yeah? And we have to personalize them. We have to bring them in. We have to make sense of them. And this big word, metta. Then we have to associate, what does that mean in my life? What is the metta move here? Yeah, to bring more metta. How are we going to do that? And anyway, so these monks, they reply, "We're keeping well, Blessed One. We're comfortable and we're not having any trouble getting our food." And just that line also, I kind of pause on each one, that it's also that feeling of gratitude for what we have, yeah? And really, like, no complaints from here. Yeah, we're comfortable living out in the forest. We're getting enough food. In one of the sutta translations, it says, our morsel food, just a little bit of food, you know. We're getting just our little bit of food. And we can actually question for ourselves, what am I thankful for on this retreat? You know, what touches me on this retreat? You know, to be here, practicing with others, you know, even when the times are very, very difficult, we can tune into that. Sometimes we're having, you know, difficult thoughts. Sometimes we're having difficult sensations in the body. Sometimes we're faced with unpleasant things or unpleasant sounds, unpleasant sights. But there's always something to be grateful for. In terms of our practice, we can be grateful even though we're hearing something very annoying noise. We can be grateful that we can hear. It's always possible. It's always something to tune into from that lens. And so we can also respect that in this society that we've traveled back to in this story, that people are being supported. For some reason, they go out and they ask for food and they're being given food, supported to exist. And we can stretch into that in our own lives and understand, well, what would that mean to be that, to make ourselves vulnerable and to be met? And it really kind of demands us to see others as equally as ourselves. That we don't view people on what they can offer us or what they offer to society, but actually it's something deeper. Something more meaningful is being valued. Something priceless about things which have no cost. About people seeking wisdom. About what you're here doing. And it goes beyond price. And so we can feel our contribution to the whole. In what do I support? What do I seek to support? What do I want to support in life? And how can I express that in the way that I practice and in the way that I live? And so all of these areas we can see are all areas for metta practice. We're actually stretching perhaps our identification. And we spoke before a little bit about this, that we look at life from terms of what can this do for me? What can I get from this experience? And as we expand with the meta lens, we can actually say more about what can we get? What can we support? What can we contribute towards? And as we say we, who are we including and not including in we? And we can look at the boundaries of the circle of our area of care and concern. Now, who's in, who's not in? And why is that? And maybe they can come in. Can they come in? Can we merge with them? Can we meet with them? And the Buddha responds, I hope that you are all living in concord, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, without arguing. And this is a wonderful image. Blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. And I think blending like milk and water so that they disappear into each other, living in harmony with each other, and looking at each other with kindly eyes are all such sweet phrases to use. And in a way, it's difficult to imagine many circumstances where that would be suitable language. You know, if our boss would come to us in a team we're working in and use that language, we might think he or she had kind of lost their mind, you know. But somehow it seems appropriate that the Buddha would just come out and say something so lovely and so kind and so willing for a sense of harmony, that people could actually lose their sense of self, their sense of individual identity, as they blended like milk and water. That we could have teachings that actually kind of point towards something like that. And yet this is actually, in a way, something that we're doing. You know, something we're doing here together is we're really harmonizing together, as we practice together. We're all contributing to this retreat. And this retreat is made up of each of us doing our part, which doesn't mean you have to be the same as everyone else. You know, being one does not mean we are the same. That was a U2 song, if you need a earworm going in. But it doesn't mean that. And when we come together, when we do the metta chant together, that whole harmonization of our body, hearts and minds and the collective together really contributes to something. When we tune into in a moment where we realize that we're all offering metta together to each other, to all beings, to everywhere, something increases. And, you know, that saying that more than the sum of its parts, so we don't just add up to being, you know, 30 or 40 individuals, it adds up to something immeasurable, something that just keeps growing and keeps expanding. And so the one monk is actually speaking for all of them this time, but speaking on behalf, we are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. And the Buddha replies, but how do you live thus? Now, how are you doing that? Venerable Sir, as to that, I think thus. I think this way. It is a gain for me. It is a great gain for me that I am living with such companions in the holy life.
So what? A gain?
A gain, like an advantage, a benefit. It's not a loss, it's a gain for me that I'm living with people like this. And any time that we're struggling in our meditation, we can tune into that. You know, as difficult as this is, it's a gain for me that others are here supporting me. And just as we are contributing to others' support, then their support is contributing to us. And that flow is constantly going on. We can tune into it or we can miss it. It's up to us. And when we need it, it's there and we can tune into it. But what this is speaking about is appreciating and developing gratitude for what is already here. Yeah, for what is already here. So what we're not normally noticing. And it can make sense just to kind of ignore the fact that we have this beautiful gift of sight, of sounds, of senses. But if we don't draw our attention to this, we won't notice it. And if we don't notice it, you know, we won't perceive it in that way, right? And if we don't perceive the benefit, we won't feel the benefit. But if we do tune into it, then we actually feel that, and we can really rest into that benefit, rest into what's already here, what's already good. You know, we're nourished by the food when we eat the food here. We feel that nourishment if we tune into it. And we can feel that it feels good to tune into the nourishment of the food. It feels good to tune into the love that's put into the food. But yet, you know, many times we forget to do that. You know, many times we're too busy in our lives to do that. But here we have that opportunity. And when we do it, it can feel pretty good, right? It's a gain. It's a great gain for us to taste our food, to taste the love in the food. And so I think that this open kind of metta attitude that these monks are displaying, you know, through their sense of gratitude for each other's company, is part of what allows them, actually in the later part of this sutta, to kind of describe their practice, which is really dipping into some of the most beautiful and sublime experiences available to the human body, heart and mind. Real self-generated joy and well-being and depth of experience is all based around this harmony that they have together, this support each other for each other's practice. And this is something we could feel here, and I think that they would feel here if they were here practicing with us. And the monk actually continues to describe how they live together in this way. And they say, I maintain bodily acts of metta. So I offer these kind of acts of body, actions that I do with this body. I use this body wisely and skillfully for being a vehicle of metta. And I do these both openly and privately, say, both obviously and secretly. Yeah, you don't need to be seen to be doing them to benefit or for another to benefit. And I also do verbal acts of metta, both openly and secretly. And I do mental acts of metta, both openly and secretly. And so I just want to have a little look at this, because I think we might discover there's quite a lot in here that might be worth unpacking in terms of our practice. So obviously, I think maybe the easiest two to understand are the bodily and the verbal acts of metta. Yeah. So in the verbal, we say nice things to people. We support them through being wise and kind and gentle and skillful in our speech. And with the bodily acts, we do things for others. You know, we're on a bus, we move our body from a seat so that someone else can sit down. Or we, at the food queue, we support other bodies by leaving plenty of food for them, or whatever else it might be. Or we carry something for someone, or we move things for each other. We get out of the way. And these are all metta. These are all examples of metta coming through our actions. But we can also look at actions of metta that support and stabilize the body. So as we were exploring in this meditation, this kind of rooting down of the tree, the rising up through the branches of the tree, are different ways of relating to the body that can be really supportive. Because many times our body energy is out of balance. And I like to use this image of like a ship that needs to be brought back into balance, you know. when the cargo in the basement of an old ship would be off, and then the whole ship would be tilted to one side, and it's very vulnerable to the waves in this way. But we can readjust that on a deeper level and get ourselves back upright. We can also notice in our body energy sometimes I'm really kind of leaning forwards. It's kind of a thirsty, greedy kind of atmosphere. I want to get to something, or I'm getting lured by some thinking into some other space. Or there can be the opposite, of where I'm really kind of leaning back and kind of wanting to get away from what is right here. We can sometimes notice that atmosphere. And so there's something really suitable and really supportive and really appropriate about getting our body into balance. And two of the ways that we can really feel out of balance is when there's too much energy and we feel like, you know, I just can't stay still. I need to move here. I need to get outside. Maybe I need to run. Or maybe, you know, it's just too much energy. Or the other one is that there's just too little energy and I'm drooping, I'm fading, I'm collapsing in on myself. And in meditation, both of those can be coming from external circumstances. And we may notice that they just particularly come up in the meditation, when I sit down, when I pay attention to my life. The immediate thing to do when we feel like body energy is out of balance is to bring a metta attitude to this. Yeah, we just recognize it. We allow for it. Yeah. We don't resist it, reject it, ignore it. And this is metta, right? This is the metta. And what's really helpful here is that when we recognize something, it becomes an object in our awareness, right? It's not to detach from or identify with, but it's now, it's not me, and it's not mine. It's what I'm bearing witness to. It's an energy. And in that moment, we kind of come out of that trance that we allowed ourselves to fall into of, I am restless. I can't stay still. I must. Or, I am too sleepy. No, I can't meditate like this. And we notice that we're kind of fixing and we're in it and we're absorbed in it. And so we kind of, the possibility of coming out and just witnessing, the body feels like this. The body energy is like this. And the Buddha quite rightly said that I am is a lie. Yeah, this I am. Anything that you can say, I am this, will be of something which is inconstant, that is changing. Doesn't make sense to identify as something which is constantly changing, something that is inconstant, or its only constancy is that it's changing, changing. You can't be that. If you're that, you too are just changing. It makes no sense to identify yourself as something that is changing. But we can ignore that change, or we can resist it, or we can attune to change. So I won't identify with something that's changing, but also we'll understand that it's changeable. Which means we can playfully investigate and experiment with this experience. And what we can see is that as well as being able to send metta through the body, that the body can actually be seen as made up of metta, made up of causes and conditions that come together, which can be flavored with metta, that the breath, as it comes into the body, can be flavored with metta. The awareness, as it comes into the body experience, as we check in with how the body feels, can be flavored by that feeling of welcoming, of opening. So when we feel tired, what happens if we tune into that quality of imagining the breath coming up and out, brightening through the branches in the tree? Yeah, what actually happens to that quality of tiredness when we allow energy to come upwards? And what happens when we bring in more brightness, bring in more light? So these are skillful uses of the imagination. Yeah. If it changes things, if it supports things, then use it. You know, sometimes this is enough to helpfully allow us to change the mood that we're in, change that quality of tiredness. That maybe that tiredness was actually tied up with some resistance to something somewhere. And that metta quality actually changes that. Sometimes we really are tired and we need to get some rest. Right? There's not some kind of predefined, this will always work kind of formula for us. It's an exploration. It's playful, patient exploration. And when there's that feeling of restlessness, of too much energy, it's also kind of sometimes a question of too much energy in or too little space. You know, we're a little bit like a wild horse that's been put in a very small pen, a small cage. It's knocking against the edges, and we're trying to control it and say, no, you're going to stay here, crossing the legs, and I'm going to sit and stay, but the restlessness keeps going. So are there ways to kind of support more space? So we can use that feeling maybe sometimes of rooting down. That can be helpful, like feeling actually rooting down is already bringing in more space. Maybe rising up is already bringing in more space. But something we can notice about awareness is where attention is led, awareness follows. Right? If you do it now, if you start listening to the furthest away sound you can hear, then your attention goes to there and your awareness naturally goes there as well. And if you start to wish to, you can actually pay attention to all the space that's around you in this room. And your awareness also spreads to there. So we can change the sense of how much space there is by what we attend to. And so one of the most skillful phrases in practice is appropriate attention. Paying attention to what is appropriate. So where you guide your attention, there your awareness follows, and that shapes your experience. Okay, and that's always true. Yeah, and really find your own way to play with this. Find your own way to sense what's skillful. So these are the bodily acts of metta. Yeah, acts we do with the body and actions and intentions and attitudes to the body experience. And those change and they can bring metta. So the obvious thing about our verbal acts is perhaps we think about how we speak to others. But of course there's all this verbal activity going on inside of how we speak to ourselves. Yeah. You may have noticed that there's often this one who just kind of talks about what's going on in our experience. Oh, you're doing this and this is going well. And, da, 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 da. And sometimes we can notice that that has a flavour. So we have to kind of be aware that is it having the metta flavour? Is it having a supportive flavour? And this inner narrator can be shaped. You know, it's also made up. It's learnt how to speak to us. And maybe it's picked up habits from people who weren't so skillful in knowing how to speak to us. And it's picked up those habits and it also speaks to us in those ways sometimes. And what's very helpful in the metta phrases is we're learning different ways to speak to ourselves. May I be happy. Yeah, may I be well. Or whatever your phrases are. Yeah, may I live with ease. Like, these may not be phrases we've picked up along the way through life of actually referring to ourselves, of saying to ourselves. So we're training in new ways, training in different, uncommon ways to talk to ourselves inside. Yeah? And so we're actually really adaptable. And that's a lovely thing. It's one of the most precious qualities. Now, there couldn't be any freedom, right, if we weren't adaptable. So yeah, we can pick up bad habits. That's fine. Because it also means we can pick up good habits. Right? Has to work both ways. We can sustain a practice, we can develop mind states, and we can come into new situations, meet new ways, and find, oh, I've actually cultivated something where the first thing I wish for is that may I live with ease. Oh, this has come up. May I live with ease. Or I meet someone new. Oh, may you be happy. So, whoa, what's happened? Yeah, we've cultivated. It's caused and conditions that bring these things together. So what you put in affects what comes out. And within this verbal realm, we can actually notice there's going to be a lot of thinking going on. And there can be this sometimes helpful myth in meditation that meditation begins when thinking stops. Yeah. A real meditation, there's just no thinking going on. But that really depends on what we mean by thinking. So there can be a lot of thinking that's wrapped up around I making, my making, me making. Yeah. We're actually making up the sense of separateness, making up the sense of self that's isolated from the sense of others. But also this thinking can also be more harmonious. We can be thinking about what I can do for others, how I can support others. But that still has a subtle sense of separation. So in a way, what we're really looking for is actually changing our thoughts, changing the verbal fabrication, the verbal, changing the word-based, I'm trying to use more simple words than verbal fabrication, changing the word-based movements inside the thinking mind so that they are more and more supportive to us. So rather than trying to make an enormous leap from thinking about me and to no thinking at all, which is like a quantum leap of an adventure, which, you know, yeah, maybe we can do that, but like step by step, maybe thinking thoughts that have a lot of getting and getting rid of to thinking thoughts that are much more supportive. Yeah, much more, what can I get, what can I give away? And then eventually those can lead to thoughts which aren't so sticky. Yeah, they don't get stuck on us. You know, these thoughts that don't have so much appeal and magnetism that they, you know, stick with us. And they start to loosen. And so maybe that's the way. Is we cultivate good thoughts, helpful thoughts, beneficial thoughts. And they don't bother us as much. And they also start to fade and pass and move through. And don't pull us away from just knowing experience. And so the Buddha didn't say this, actually. I just noticed something before we get back to the good old Buddha. I think this was like just a bumper sticker, but it just says, don't believe everything you think. But what is more important is noticing the flavor of the thinking, yeah, the atmosphere of the thinking. And of course, what we know is that we can bring this kind of meta flavor into our thinking, into the way we think, and how we relate to our thinking. You know, both those elements. Actually, the contents of the thoughts are in tune with metta, and also how we meet those thoughts are in tune with welcoming and allowing and letting to go. And one way of speaking about skillful use of thinking is this quality of discernment. Discernment. So in meditation, it's this quality of knowing what happens when I do this? So discernment is knowing the difference between two qualities. So great. So we don't want to just get rid of all thinking or all ability to make judgments about experience. We want to be able to taste and experience what they are. And one of the most important qualities of this discernment is in the flavor of our thinking. And the Buddha put it basically into two camps of there's
discernment.
So discernment is this word we had. Yeah, okay. Of thinking which has the flavor of metta and thinking which doesn't have the flavor of metta. There's basically just two types of thinking, And we could also say there's thinking which leads to suffering and dukkha, and there's thinking which leads to ease and peacefulness. And so if we treat all types of thinking as a problem, or as the same kind of problem, that's really kind of missing the simple and the obvious beauty of this teaching. And instead, this actually gives us something to move with, something to go with. So if we are having thoughts which are obsessing about getting sensual pleasures, getting something more, we can have a lot of thoughts which kind of have that flavor, yeah. Or we could have a lot of thoughts which are about getting rid of something or fixing something so it's not around and scheming to have something our way. Then we can see that, you know, these are not metta modes, yeah. And they can even go into kind of getting revenge for something, you know, doing harm to someone in some way. You see, oh yeah, these thoughts do not lead to my welfare and they do not lead to the welfare of others. And so it's really wise to just not do that. When we see it from that benefit, is this for my benefit? Is this for the benefit of others? And if we say no, and then we might say, do I want to continue doing this? Say, yeah. A little bit longer, you know. But we know, you know, yeah, this isn't what I'm on retreat for. This isn't what I've taken birth for. This isn't what I want to do with my life. And so we're going to be contributing towards the causes and conditions for future dukkha, or dukkha in the moment even, really, yeah. It's addictive, it's tempting to go down this route, but it's really not good for us. It's not bringing any good to the world. And then so the opposite is these kind of thoughts he refers to as thoughts of renunciation. So instead of thoughts of getting something, thoughts of letting go of something. And instead of thoughts of getting rid of something, these thoughts of friendliness, of welcoming, you know, what we're calling metta here. Or even instead of thoughts of harming others, it's thoughts of compassion, thoughts of care, thoughts of kindness in that way. And I really love this simplicity, and it just feels so accessible. And it quite literally goes all the way. You know, it's one of the teachings that the Buddha tells with another leap back into the past, that he tells of himself before awakening. He just simply decided to divide his thinking into two sorts. Yeah. Thoughts with this flavor of metta, thoughts that didn't have this flavor of metta. And then he sits under the tree. And the whole fireworks of awakening happen for him. Just from that simple insight of investigating what we fabricate with the mind, what we make up with the mind. And so I'm just going to close with a sense that we've talked about the body, and we've talked about the verbal, which was the intellect. But this monk was speaking about doing mental acts of metta. And I just feel like we've done the body, we've done the thinking, and now he gives another category, these mental acts, and I just wonder if we can just leave it there and you know what mental acts of metta are, and we can just meditate on that, and that's all very clear. And just on the off chance that it's not. So what makes up the rest of experience that might be something we can adjust and adapt? And so we've been speaking about perception, the way we look, yeah? what we look for. And that ties in with intentions. So these intentions, behind every action that we do, there is an intention to do that action. And they can be flavored with metta. And they can be flavored with non-metta, yeah. And we can see that we're starting to shape the things which go on a deeper level. And so we're cultivating positive habits to contribute towards things which are not so clearly in our consciousness, yeah. We don't consciously see an intention rise up so that we can say, is this metta or not? And then move forward. So we need to kind of be contributing to something in the roots of our experience that are out of sight, that kind of come into being. And we need to do that by appreciating what's already here. You know, by gratitude, we actually cultivate a sense of being safe. Yeah, that sense of being okay, that sense of having enough. That we keep tuning into that, and that contributes to different kinds of intentions. Then if we contribute to a mind state which feels like, I'm not safe, I haven't got enough, then we feel that we need to feed this being in different ways. So it's quite a slow-going practice. But we might want to ask, is it really worth doing something that has remarkable rewards, even though it's we can't see the fruits immediately? But we see it over time. We see it contributing over time. And we may not actually notice it at all. Our own ability to pay attention to the changes that are happening within us and the changes which are happening in the lens in which we see through is very, very hard to see, because it's the lens through which we see through, right? It's hard to see the lens. It's like wearing a pair of clear glasses. You know, you look through them. And then if somebody slowly was changing the colour of those glasses, or those glasses were slowly being cleaned, we might not notice that our vision was becoming brighter or changing its shades. But to know, you know, this is what we're contributing towards. We're contributing towards the soil of experience, the deep soil of experience. And then through there, we're also contributing seeds that we plant in that soil. And through our practice, we're also contributing to the nourishment qualities through the metta, through the attitude, that allow those things to grow into being. And then altogether, we have bodily acts of metta, verbal acts of metta, and mental acts of metta, supporting the intention, the perception. And tomorrow, we'll go into one more, which is the Vedana. Which is Vedana. You shouldn't understand that word, because we'll do it tomorrow. Of actually another quality that we have that's contributing and that can be guided towards a metta way. But in brief, it's that moment that we notice, is this something I want or something I don't want? And it happens on a very, very subtle level. And it's always going on. And it's something that we can shape. And if we don't pay attention to it, it can lead to us wanting to get things or wanting to get rid of things. Or if it's neither of those, it ends up with us not really caring about this thing. And we can really sense that none of those sound like metta. Yeah? Getting rid of, not caring. None of those really sound like metta. So we need to find ways in which we can relate. And we can recognize that it's against the habits of a lifetime, as I was saying yesterday. You know, it's these slow, gradual changes that we're really developing. I have a choice. Yeah, it's a hard one, maybe. It's going against the stream. Meditation isn't easy. But even when it's hard, we are contributing to what is good. Yeah. We're contributing to what is meaningful. And so, you know, for this reason alone, as I have a lot of appreciation for your practice that we're doing together, and I hope that the fruits of this practice come to you. Maybe let's take a few moments just to investigate and see what comes up in our experience. You know, how's the energy in the body? Can we divide our thinking into two sorts of thinking? And we can just ask, what can I cultivate for more ease and less dukkha?
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.